Accession number 15226, reel number 1.
These are a few memories of the Kingston upon Hull Civil Defence Cyclist Messenger Corps, of which I was a member. I joined in 1940 and was 18 at the time. Dates are difficult to recall after 52 years, but these incidents took place during the heavy attacks in the city during 1941. On one occasion, I was based at a district warden post in Pickering Road, and on the first occasion, during heavy raids, I was sent to the main control centre at Shell House in Furrinsway in order to reinforce their messenger unit, which was heavily engaged due to a serious failure of telephone communications. On the way on my cycle, I ran into a wrecked vehicle in the blackout, and my cycle front wheel was badly buckled. I was about to continue on foot, reluctantly abandoning the cycle, but a police officer commandeered me to help shepherd some shocked and very dazed old people from a bombed shelter in Bean Street, to take them across the Annaby Road to the Western General Hospital grounds, where there was a first aid and welfare centre. I was asked to accompany an old man who was carrying a cage covered by a piece of curtain material. The old man and the cage were completely covered in cement dust and dirt from the blast, and I had to steer him across the road as he was disorientated and very dazed by the noise of anti-aircraft gunfire and bombs which were still falling fairly near. Despite his peril and shock, the old man cared only for the welfare of his budgie, and he tried to stop in the middle of the Annaby Road to inspect the bird. This was very perilous, as there was plenty of civil defence and emergency traffic, ambulances, fire brigade, etc., using the road. Anyway, the darkness and my efforts prevented him from attempting this, and at last I managed to persuade him to cross the road into the casualty welfare reception area in front of the hospital. The old man, by the way, I never found out his name, resisted all attempts by the welfare section volunteers to attend to his needs. He was determined to be allowed to take off the piece of curtaining covering the cage to check on the welfare of his old friend, the budgie. The bird was huddled on the floor of the cage, covered in dust and apparently dead. However, the welfare volunteer lady, obviously a bird fancier, tenderly picked up the budgie, blew off the dust, and revived the bird by means of very weak brandy and TLC, better known as tender loving care. The effect on the old man was miraculous. He at once became revived and belligerent towards the Luftwaffe. His world had been restored to him. The dangers of the Blitz, the blackout, the shock to his system, his filthy state covered in dust and grime, meant nothing to him compared with the welfare of his only friend. Such was the spirit of the people of Kingston upon Hull in these trying and perilous times. The warden post in Pickering Road, to which I was attached in the Cyclist Messenger Corps, was a solid concrete structure of a type familiar to any of my present-day contemporaries. It was large enough to contain a desk, a chair, a telephone, and I think two or three bunks for the duty wardens, the wardens who reported for full-time duty, full-time paid duty, and were on duty also, of course, during raids. Behind the warden post, which was situated on the grass verge of Pickering Road, in one of the houses, we were allocated leisure facilities, such as games, such as, I think there was a snooker table there, and darts and table tennis, etc., for the use of the volunteers who attended in their own time, at their own expense, and of course sometimes after a full day's work, and they may be expected to stay on duty through the night if the air raid siren has sounded. We were also provided with rudimentary cooking facilities, cooker, kettles, cups and saucers, etc., for our refreshment and entertainment during the long hours of duty. On a typical evening, there may have been several volunteers taking part in the games, listening to the radio. Also, the messengers would be there, standing by for any calls to take messages here, there and everywhere. Not only in air raids, of course, but during breaks. And the radio we had, I remember, was a solid mahogany instrument with four large knobs on the front and an illuminated dial, and it was necessary to juggle with the wave chain switch and at the same time give the instrument a hearty bang, and it would then be induced to either change to the correct channel, which could have been, I believe in those days, home service or light program, or even stop working altogether. We continued with the off-duty activities until, as almost every night at this time in 1941, the air raid sirens would sound. Of course, leisure activities would cease temporarily. We would assume a ready position. The wardens would start their patrol, fully equipped with their steel helmets and service respirators and any equipment they may need. The cyclist messengers would already have checked their cycles during the times of no air raids, but would then stand by ready to be sent on messages such as were necessary. These could consist of written messages and very occasionally verbal. Could go to any civil defence establishment, police station, fire brigade, fire services, auxiliary fire services, the ambulance service, hospitals, rest centres, decontamination centres, the list is endless. So these boys and girls had to know the geography of the city. They had to know their way around. They would already have been trained on the maps in the headquarters for the locations of the various ARP, air raid precautions, that is, centres, civil defence posts, etc. But this was no easy job. It was a dangerous job. It was also uncomfortable. The trips would be taken in any weather. I'm afraid Mr. Hitler was no respecter of weather, and neither was the Luftwaffe. These boys and girls would undertake these hazardous duties, as I say, at any time, in any kind of weather, quite cheerfully. In fact, I believe that all of them, all that I ever met anyway, looked upon it as a great thing to be able to help their adult colleagues in the war effort. Moreover, I should point out that whereas the wardens and other adult civil defence personnel were issued with full protective clothing, such as long oilskin coats, gumboots, gloves, etc., the messengers were issued with only one item of equipment. That was a helmet. At first we used steel helmets, but these proved to be too clumsy and too heavy for use on a cycle, especially by the younger messengers, so these were replaced by plastic helmets of a type similar to the present-day cyclist helmets, but larger and a little heavier. These were the only item of equipment, as I've said. The messengers used their own civilian-type respirators, not the service respirator issued to the wardens, which was identical to that issued to the armed forces. And they used their own cycles, of course, at their own expense, quite cheerfully. Any repairs that were necessary, if they were caused during duty hours, were in some cases paid for by the service after a lot of argument. But these boys and girls carried on regardless of the weather, the conditions, the attacks, the blackout, anything else, doing their job quite cheerfully and well. One evening during a raid in which nothing much seemed to be happening, but the weather was very bad, it was raining quite heavily and it was windy, I was riding back towards Pickering Road, heading west along Anlaby Road, and had reached a point round about Stirling Street area. Then I heard this aircraft overhead, and although there had been no bombing or anti-aircraft for the last 20 minutes or so, suddenly I heard this bomb falling. Now, when you hear a bomb falling, you are convinced that it is heading through a spot in the middle of your shoulders. At least that is how it appeared to me. I immediately ran as fast as I could to try to reach the headquarters, the warden post, as quickly as possible. The bomb must have fallen somewhere in the area of Stirling Street, and I was opposite that point. I don't remember hearing an explosion, but I do remember being lifted from my cycle by the blast, and I remember being blown through the air in a horizontal position and then blacked out. I came back to my senses, found myself lying in wet grass with my head against the upright timber support of some hoardings, with a nasty headache. A passing warden came to my help, helped me to my feet, and I found my helmet had a delve across the middle of it. If I had not been wearing the helmet, the delve would have been in my head. All I was worried about at that moment was the cycle. It was fairly new, and I had bought it with the help of tips from kind uncles, pocket money, etc., whilst I was still at school in 1939. But it was a good cycle. I found that it had been blown alongside me, but had not quite reached the hoardings. It was completely undamaged. Anyway, after I was consoled, helped by the warden, I was able to cycle back to the warden post on Pickering Road. I didn't mention this to anyone, as far worse things than that happening, but one of the wardens noticed a delve in my helmet, and of course I was forced to tell the story. So I was provided with cups of hot sweet tea in the time honoured fashion, but didn't feel any shock and was able to carry on as usual. Extremely fortunate, because had I hit the hoardings perhaps in a different posture, I would certainly have received broken limbs at least. In the Costello playing fields, quite near to the warden post in Pickering Road, there was at that time, situated where the present Tartan Athletic Track can be found, there was situated a Royal Artillery anti-aircraft battery. One evening there had been a nuisance raid in progress. The nuisance raid was one in which the enemy aircraft cruised overhead at a great height, too high for use of anti-aircraft to be any use, and cruised around, sometimes not bothering to drop bombs, simply to actuate the air raid warnings and to cause the fighter squadrons to scramble, and not really doing much damage. The theory was sometimes that they were out of bombs, they'd used all their bombs elsewhere, or they were simply skiving, not doing the job as they should do. Anyway, this chap was cruising around up above, trying to dodge the searchlights. And we were standing by, of course, because there was an air raid in progress, although nothing much happening. When suddenly he appeared to head towards us. We couldn't see him, of course, but the searchlights all bent over to a spot almost overhead. Then the whole area was lit up. He dropped about 100 incendiary bombs, most of which fell in the playing fields around the artillery, the anti-aircraft battery. Of course, soldiers turned out to help deal with these, but we were asked to assist. So the whole personnel of the warden post and all the messengers, except for one man who was left to man the telephone, turned out with spades to help the soldiers. There were also quite a few local residents, civilians, who'd seen or heard this, and they realised they could help also and did the same thing. The idea was to throw soil onto the bombs. Luckily, it had been quite a wet day and the soil was quite damp, to smother the bombs and preclude them of oxygen. This worked well enough, but there was a critical point at which one should stand. Too near and one would probably lose some facial hair, or at least have first degree burns to the face and hands. Too far away and it was difficult to aim the shovelful of soil accurately. Anyway, we continued this for, I can't remember how long. It seemed to take a long time, and luckily the aircraft above didn't take any further action. Either he'd used up all his high explosive bombs, or had been chased away by our fighters. We'd never found out. Anyway, we managed to extinguish the bombs successfully. When the last one had been dealt with, we were quite physically tired, of course, and headed off back to the warden post for a very welcome rest and a cup of tea. Nothing much else happened during that raid, and shortly afterwards the all clear sounded. A few days later, an army truck drew up outside the Pickering Road warden post. From it stepped a young officer and two gunners. The gunners proceeded to unload from the back of the truck three or four crates of beer, several packs of very welcome cigarettes, four or five bags of sugar, and about 2 pounds in weight of tea, all of which were very, very welcome to the permanent and volunteer members of the warden post. The officer expressed the thanks of his commanding officer, the major, to the wardens and messengers for their help in extinguishing the bombs, and said that there would not have been sufficient soldiers to carry out the job, as most of them of course had to stay on duty at the guns, and the officer in charge, the major, had been worried in case the glare lit up the battery long enough for other aircraft to come along and attack. As it happened, this did not occur, but he was very grateful to our personnel, and expressed his thanks in the way I've described. Of course, the beer and cigarettes were very welcome, but perhaps even more so, as older listeners will remember, the rationing taking place in those days, the tea and sugar were especially welcome to people who were spending long hours on watch. And everyone will tell you, who lived through it, that the war was won by cups of tea and cigarettes. We were especially pleased to drink the health of the Royal Artillery after that occasion, the messengers in tea, because most of them were under 18, and the wardens, of course, in beer. And the cigarettes, of course, were especially enjoyed by those who, in those days, smoked, and that was very many people indeed, compared with today. In these modern times, the use of electronic communications is so widespread and so general that most people of today will wonder why we had to send out cyclist messengers during wartime. Well, it must be remembered that in those days, 52 years ago, the only telephones in use were fixed static telephones in buildings. No one had mobile phones. Very few vehicles were fitted with anything like a mobile telephone. It's true that many services vehicles in the armed forces were fitted with radio, but nothing like a mobile telephone. Damage by enemy action to telephone installations was quite common, not only by the action of high explosive bombs themselves falling on telephone installations and telephone exchanges, etc., but even the blast from certain bombs was sufficient to bring down overhead telephone wires, and most fixed telephones were served by overhead wires. In these circumstances, therefore, it was essential that should telephone communication be cut off at a moment's notice, as usual, at any civil defence installation, a messenger must be available to take the message to any other civil defence installation where it was needed, or to collect replies from messages. In the First World War, one of the most dangerous jobs known was that of the company runner, the messenger, who often had to take messages under quite severe fire, and the dispatch rider also had a similar function, and often in danger also. The Civil Defence Cyclist Messenger Corps did the same job as civilians during air raids in this country. And many times, despite their youth, were subject to very similar dangers from falling shrapnel from our own anti-aircraft or bombs themselves. In order to carry out this duty, the youngsters were trained in several aspects of their job. I myself had to leave the service to join the armed forces much earlier than the time at which this training was set up in any large degree. But many of the messengers had already received some training as scouts and guides, or members of the Air Training Corps or similar organisations, so they were able to operate a telephone if necessary, but even more important, carry a verbal message without getting it mixed up, or carry a written message and make sure it was delivered to the right person at the right place and in the shortest possible time. In order to make things more interesting, the head warden sometimes laid on exercises in which we took part in actual action, simulating real action, such as a raid taking place in a fictitious area on paper, at which we would decide what action would be taken, what message would be sent, and for the messengers to decide which route to take for it to be safest and quickest. And sometimes between the messengers he organised quizzes which stimulated us and increased our knowledge of the city geography, which of course was essential for people who had to find their way about in the blackout during raids. And we enjoyed this a great deal. City maps were pored over for a long time, and we also found the street guide very useful, which was a book issued in conjunction with the maps, in which the number of houses and properties in every street was marked in the book. For instance, if one wanted to find the location of, let's take a fictitious place, 65 Devonshire Street, it would be found in the book at the corner of Lizzie's Terrace, which made things quite interesting, and helped us to find an address in a hurry so that we'd be able to get there in the shortest possible time and in the safest route, which were the two criteria which we messengers were encouraged to follow. The most heavily concentrated enemy attacks which I can remember took place during 1941 in the month of May, over three nights. I was at that time working as a junior clerk in the Guildhall, and after a very heavy night of it on civil defence duty, the following morning I set off for work in the usual way, bicycle of course. It took me three or four times as long to get to work along Anlaby Road. Most of the road was blocked by debris and civil defence vehicles trying to find their way, so I took several detours along such streets as Wheeler Street, Woodcock Street, Cross Boulevard, and finally managed to get to the Guildhall. On arrival, we were all met by our bosses, who advised us that the building had been quite severely damaged at the eastern end, and they asked us to put on boiler suits and help in recovering whatever could be recovered from the debris. My place of work at that time was in the banqueting room at the eastern end of the Guildhall, and on finding my way there, I couldn't find the place where my desk had been. In its place was a large hole in the floor, with a corresponding large hole in the roof above. No sign of my desk whatsoever. The rest of the banqueting room was a scene of terrible damage. Most of the windows had gone, and some of them were quite valuable stained glass. All the decorations had gone, most desks were destroyed or damaged, and of course all the documents, files, telephones, typewriters, everything were scattered about the room or smashed. Anyway, we managed to save as many ledgers, files, documents and what have you as we could, and took them away to undamaged parts of the building. The rest of the day was spent helping to clear up the incidental damage in other parts. That day, to me, although I was very sorry about the damage, that was a more enjoyable day to me. It was better than sitting at a desk pushing a pen. I left the Civil Defence Cyclist Messenger Corps and the city at the end of June to join the Royal Air Force, and